as a one of the three representatives of the Pat's Labor Council, it is now my turn to attempt the intro. So welcome to Pat's Labor, a podcast about anime.
I don't even remember when I stopped, but I think that might have been...
Yeah. I think that's a new record for earliest stoppage. Yeah. Welcome to Pat's Labor, a podcast about the anime Pat Labor and Pat's Labor to learn about labor history through the prism of Pat Labor. I'm Patrick Gill.
I'm Tucson Egan.
And I am Clayton Ashley.
Wow. We intuitively got the order on that one.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
That felt good.
Yeah. All we got to do is just get that first, like, the actual, like, first stumble. Like, don't stumble at before anime Pat Labor.
Okay.
I could edit it out. But this is like a working men's podcast, and you got to see the work happen.
Yeah.
Yes. Yep. We don't want to disguise the labor that goes into making this.
No, never.
This is how the podcast sausage gets made.
And this was such an episode of Pat Labor.
Yes, it was.
I felt like after the last one, I was like, okay, I think I get it. I get what Pat Labor is about. No, not really.
No.
It
was such a swerve.
This one rocks. The episode of this one is...
To be clear, yes.
The title of this episode is the 450 million year trap?
Yes.
What was it?
Yes.
Year old trap, yeah.
I didn't know that. I don't know why. I just didn't look at the title until the end when they said it. And I was like, well, I think I might have been spoiled a tiny bit if I saw that. But still, I don't think I would have known what the hell was going with that.
Yeah.
And this is a episode that starts unlike other episodes. Because it sort of has a monster of the week intro where it's like very classic horror film. It's a couple getting up to some rude business in a car by the harbor.
That's a nice way of putting it. That's a nice way of putting it. Like both like a little salacious, but also just polite enough to like you can connect the dots as to what we're saying.
Yes. And very politely. The gentleman runs out of the car to go get a Coke from the Coke machine. And it is not a McDonald's Coke. It says Coca-Cola on it.
Yeah.
I was wondering if anybody else was going to note that. Because now I feel like I'm looking for when do they use real brands? When do they fake them? And I'm kind of surprised about that one, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
And when he comes back to the car is no longer there.
Dun, dun, dun. What happened to the car?
Also, like pretty clearly something to do with the fact it was by the water.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
But otherwise, this is a pretty like what I got from this beginning was like the nighttime, the fog. I thought they were going really noir with it. And I thought that's what we were going to get. And they do a bit of that in some ways, but.
It's funny that you mentioned that because this episode in particular reminded me of an episode or two episodes from one of my favorite giant robot animes, which is the Big O. That episode was Electric City. And I think there was another one, which was Bring Back My Ghost. Like, yeah. So it reminded me of those two episodes because they both entail like a mystery that surrounds like a specific body of water adjourning their respective city locales. Yeah.
Yes, there were two directions it felt like it could have gone from the very beginning, and noir was one of them for me. Just the moody music, the babe sitting in a car at nighttime.
Her fingers caressing the AM/FM radio.
Yeah, turning it down. It's like, what's that noise? And it's like, glug, 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 glug. And then it zooms in on her mouth and then on her eyes, and then it just like immediately cuts with the music to the sound of the Coca-Cola falling into the vending machine. It was pretty good. I mean, that was a good cut. Like,
I was going to come back to this, but I feel like this episode kind of highlighted for me that like there are ways that animation saves money. There's ways that I think anime is kind of known for like how often they'll just have still imagery or reuse things, avoid animating the mouth if it can. Mm-hmm. And that happens in this. But to me, this is an episode that Pat Labor has kind of exemplified that sometimes that means something that ends up looking cheap. And other times it means the creatives have to think how to work with that sort of like restriction of budget.
Mm-hmm.
And every time there's something you could call like money saving in this, they did it in a way that's sick as shit. I mean, or just like really creative, like the idea of like, we're not going to show you this big action thing of what happened to the car. Instead, we're going to cut to almost a jokey, like the Coca-Cola can falling. But that's such a good cinematic way to do it that I don't blame them for saving money. It's actually like better in some ways to heighten that.
No, with the monster. I fully agree with you. Yeah. You can see the same sort of limited animation money saving stuff happen in the show, but at no point does it hit the point for me where it's like, oh God, I'm bored. Right. Like watching old episodes of One Piece, right. Just like I think a big part of it is like pacing, right. Because mm-hmm. like there are a lot of reasons that sort of stuff happens in animation. One of them is to save money, which is, I think, probably the paramount one. The other one is to stretch out the content to the pacing of the show so that the show doesn't get too far ahead of whatever it's based on. And I think the fact that Pat Labor here is, these are these little sort of one-off episode stories. It's not part of like a long arc that needs to be stretched out, means they're less beholden to taking up time when they don't want to take up time.
And the fact that it's an original series that is going at its own pace rather than just waiting for, oh yeah, we got to wait for the next batch of chapters to come out, so we got to pad this a little bit. It's like, no, this is why this model for at least this specific anime with Headgear, like conceiving of this works. And those limitations really do breed like really inventive, creative visual elements that I really love about the show. Yeah.
And I think also they own it. Go ahead. Yeah.
I mean, you brought up Headgear, Toussaint. And I was just thinking, like, they also own it. So they're like, they care that this property does well. So the quality is there also, perhaps for that reason. And it's interesting to think about why that makes this a better anime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's also the last thing I just thought of is that it's also just a really good fit for the tone and pace of the show, right? That's another thing that can make limited animation feel really noticeable and annoying in some shows, is like when you can tell that the heart of the show is go, go, go. Like, like reading One Piece in manga form, it's like every page is just people fucking running around doing stuff, and Oda drawing 1,000 characters per page. So then when you see it translated to a thing where it by necessity has to slow down, it feels more awkward. Mm-hmm. This is a show where you don't feel like its heart is somewhere other than this sort of slow, methodical pace that it moves at. And so like anytime there's just like a still beautiful shot of people sitting around waiting for something, that's not like, oh God, it's like, oh haha, they're waiting again.
Yeah. It's like literally how I felt about Dragon Ball Z when I was a kid, admittedly, and more impatient. But like, why does this smoke clearing take 2 episodes? Like, I just get back to the fighting.
But it makes sense in this context because they're literally police, and part of their job is just to hurry up and wait. Hurry up and wait. That's your job.
I wrote down hurry up and wait on the page again as a recurring theme that comes back. It is so good. So we start with this very X-Files, very Monster of the Week cold open where a couple encounters some monstrous force from the Tokyo Bay. And then we cut to Pat Labor headquarters, the hangar, where the 2nd Division is hanging out. And they are shooting a shotgun into the water.
But what are they shooting at? What is the target? The target that they're shooting at, they don't mention it by name, but the design of that actual alien on the target in the water, it's modeled after Alien Baltan, a recurring antagonist, one of the iconic early antagonists of Ultraman. So this is very much rooted in Japanese popular culture. We don't need to explain who that is, but like as soon as I saw that character design, I was like, I know what that character is. I haven't watched a lot of Ultraman, but I know what that character is. Like,
I recognized him, and I had to look him. I had to scroll through a wiki of every Godzilla monster before I realized, oh, it's probably from Ultraman. But yeah,
I just did Ultraman monster with claws, and I got Alien. But I'm just like sick. I knew it. Nice.
I felt like I knew one of you would know what it was, but I was like, oh, that seems familiar. I don't know where from. So I'm glad you got that Ultraman
reference. Yeah.
It won't be the only. Would that be considered a kaiju within Ultraman?
Oh yeah, that's a kaiju within Ultraman. Yeah,
not to spoil it, but this episode is rife with references to kaiju movies, which is not what I expected from Pat Labor, but is also really cool.
Yeah, kaiju, tokusatsu, mecha, like all these things are rubbing shoulders with one another. Yeah.
In a really comedic way here, because there is immediately the classic Pat Labor joke. after we see this, they shoot the riot gun, which just looks like a standard, like, police issue shotgun.
I love that that's the riot gun. That's what we need for riots.
And it makes a massive explosion in the water, and everyone's cheering, and everyone's really excited because this thing just, they just shot a huge-ass gun at a buoy. And then immediately, both the chief and the commander of the unit say, that's way too dangerous. We can't use that.
Yeah. Yeah. I was like, it was sick as shit. I'm just like, what is the practical use case for something like this? Like, it's a riot gun? Like, how is that supposed to defuse a riot? It literally just blew that thing out of the water. It was sick as shit, though, boss. I'm just like, yeah, I'm afraid they're right.
And I feel like I'm now ready already on episode 3 of Pat Labor that there's something that's almost like their version of Chekhov's gun, which is that if there's something really cool hyped up at the beginning, they're absolutely not going to use it later. It'll be the punchline of something.
Yes.
That is a very good point. That's really funny.
Chekhov's prop gun.
Yeah.
Chekhov's prop gun where it's just like a bang. Like, yeah.
But then we kind of get a shift back here from that. That felt very like what we expect from Pat Labor. But then we get back to like another character out of a noir movie where this detective from what was his agency called? It was like Criminal Investigations or something.
Criminal Investigations Division. I believe it's of the Tokyo Police. His name is Inspector Matsui. And Matsui is another character that I recognize because he will be relevant in the Pat Labor movie. This stuff is...
Oh, cool.
Every single episode has some thread that is in some way hearkening to something that's gonna cap off with that movie. It's amazing having watched that film multiple times and now watching this. I'm like, oh, wow, they really laid the groundwork for this leading up there.
Oh, that's sick. Yeah. That makes me even more excited for it.
Yeah.
But he's there to deliver, like... He's actually not there about... the intro. He's not explicitly. He's there because there have been some issues in Tokyo Bay. An undersea cable from the Babylon project was cut.
Yeah.
And I feel that there was something else that he mentions. But then after they're just kind of talking with the Pat Labor commander about this and how they got a robot to kind of undersea, deep sea submersible to investigate Tokyo Bay. But none of them know how to use it. So like, hey, your division, you're the techies, you're the gearheads. Can you guys run this? He doesn't say it that way. He talks very much like he's stepped right out of a noir detective kind of future. But this is essentially what he's communicating. And then he's also like, oh, yeah, there's also this kind of weird thing where a car where two people were making out in it near Tokyo Bay got dragged into the bay.
But the tire treads. Yeah.
are sideways. And I love that he doesn't just say this, but he demonstrates by showing his packet carton of cigarettes. He crushes it with his hand and drags it over the side of the desk. And again, minimal animation, but so evocative of both this character and describing exactly what happened without ever showing that crime scene again.
Yeah, I had that thought too. Specifically when I saw that, you know, because you know, it's a couple frames of animation of the hand going like this, and then, you know, it's limited animation of the hand sliding off the table. It didn't look cheap. It was like, oh, God, that's so good. And it was like, it gave me like slight goosebumps. I was like, oh, that's so scary when you like look at it like that.
Yeah.
But in that scene, we do learn that the woman in the car was not killed. She was rendered unconscious and has not been able to talk about what she saw without freaking out. So she saw something strange that night at the pier.
Inexplicable.
Yeah. And they don't want to call the SDF for some reason. So the self-defense force.
They don't want to set a precedent that they don't want the SDF to like have to deal with domestic peacekeeping like issues. And it's like, because they really want to withhold. I know.
Feel relevant.
Yeah, they don't. They don't want to set a precedent, and they want to have a firm division between each of these divisions is what they're doing. So, separation of powers. Interesting idea. Yeah.
Novel concept from this.
We also get a little, we get this little hint at something foreshadowing is that like, while SV2 is just kind of like preparing for the submersible thing, they're actually they're talking about how can they get out of the job of actually dealing with it? Cause it's going to be annoying.
Yeah.
But then in the background, they see this guy who... I'm going to describe him.
Please, Pat, describe him. I don't... I could try to describe him, but I feel like you could do a better job at this.
He's a man with prominent cheekbones, a sort of disheveled demeanor, and an eye patch. And he is wearing a lab coat. And he is fully just a caricature of Serizawa, the eye-patched doctor from the original Japanese release of Godzilla.
Oh, my God. That's awesome. Yeah.
That's great. Because I knew this was like an archetype of those movies, but I didn't realize he was like referencing a specific guy. So,
Yeah. The guy who creates the oxygen destroyer in the first Godzilla film, Daisuke Serizawa.
That's also...
And that's going to come up too, and it's very funny when it does.
Wasn't that also in Godzilla Minus One, or is there some type of equivalent to that where they put in Godzilla's mouth at like a deep?
They bring back the concept of the oxygen destroyer. In
yes,
One.
I thought
they bring
so.
It
yeah,
back
yeah.
and like tweak it in a way that makes it part of their plan in a really cool way. But I didn't even connect to that. That these are all riffing on that, which is really cool.
Yeah.
But so we get a glimpse of this Serizawa lookalike character. He's like raving and yelling, and he's being pushed out of the police headquarters. And they don't want him involved in whatever this is. And this character's name is Harada, and he will come back in a bit. But for now, we get a scene of them sending the probe down under the sea. It's very cool, very moody, and it's shot in a way that I think was intentionally there to fool me. Which is you think that they are in the probe, right?
Yes.
Unless I missed something.
Yeah, no. I thought the same thing too, because then they show it from a sort of like a face forward sort of view where it has Shige, who is like handling the controls, and Matsui is like to his, I think he's to his like right on his corner, and his face, like the way that it looks, it makes it look like it's a fishbowl. Fish-eyed lens, and I'm just wait a minute. It's like they don't have a fisheye in this fish-eyed lens. Something's fishy here. I'm just like, I didn't even intend to do that, but they sort of trip you up to make you think that it's inside the actual drone when really it's just remote controlled. Yeah.
Yes, because they use that for a gag where they patrol for a while, they find something under the water. You get the classic horror movie, like there's something on the radar, ding, 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 it's getting closer, and then, a shape emerges from a cloud of kicked up silt and crushes the probe. And then that's when we get the cut to all of them. And that's where it's very clear for the first time that the crew operating it, they were doing it remotely. They're just in a big boardroom.
I almost want to go back and watch it. I don't know if it's because I saw that the submersible had cables and maybe I thought they said it was a remote thing.
They could have said it was remote and then I just missed it.
Yeah.
Well, but I also noted the fisheye thing because I was like, that was such a distinct way because like from my view was like, okay, this is the robot. They're doing this through the robot. They're still adding the claustrophobia to the room they're in to try to, because they're all like hunched over each other's shoulders. That fisheye shot makes them look literally like packed together. And I thought there was something to that. And I think maybe the other part that I thought about it being like, they're not on it. And it didn't occur to me really is that at one point the commander's like, use the fins. Don't use the fans. We don't want to kick up silt. They made this detail. And then the next scene is silt getting kicked up. So then, you know, you eventually figure out that's the monster doing it. But I think it was the fact that he was talking about it and commanding it like it was a robot that made me think that way. But I think it's interesting that, like, the claustrophobia of it. The claustrophobia is definitely there either way. And it's meant to make them feel scared about even the scanner. Because that's the alien thing. I mean, that's maybe the thing I'm thinking of like the pings getting closer. They're not in danger when that happens, but it's still scary and tense.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do want to make one last note about this whole fish-eyed lens thing. And that is Mamoru Oshii loves fish-eyed lens views. And I didn't realize how much he loved them until now, because it's in this episode. It's there's also a faux fish-eyed lens in Pat Labor the movie, and in Pat Labor 2, and in Ghosts in the Shell. Like, it's a recurring thing for him all the time that he's always fitting that into. I think there might actually be one in the second Yurusei Yatsura movie, but I have to go back and rewatch that. Yeah.
I also wonder, maybe this is another thing that occurred to me, is I almost thought of it if like they're operating the robot, but that's like the robot peering back at them. And I wonder if there's some motif there about like, this is how a robot sees the world, which is in a distorted different way than humans see, because they're not human. But
yeah,
I'd be curious what those other motifs are as we get to them.
Yeah. It's sort of his answer to a canted angle, which is meant to like make the audience feel like, unmoored and from reality. Like something's up. Something is fishy. Something is very wrong.
Very fishy. And once again, we get the classic Pat Labor moment in here, where in the midst of this sort of horror, this deep sea horror exploration sequence, we do get the line, "If we don't return this labor tonight, they'll charge us for an overdue fine." Oh, so they are never not thinking about budgeting and deadlines and the annoyances of bureaucracy.
They are never not nickeled and dimed on this and just like totally up their ass about money. This is ridiculous. Like, just chill.
Actually, another thing to think about is they didn't get that gun. They built the riot gun from scrap parts. They had to do that themselves. So they're always making sure you know that, yes, they're still strapped for cash. But I think what's interesting there specifically with the submarine rental fee is it's like the intensity of getting this done is not like someone's going to die or like someone's in danger. It's we might get charged more money. So
yeah,
get to work.
So after the probe gets completely wrecked by whatever's under the water, after that, Shige, who is the sort of second in command, the technical chief, becomes convinced that they are dealing with some sort of advanced sea monster, and he orders some dry ice from online for some reasons, which we will later understand. And at this point, Harada re-enters the story, who is our eye-patched mad scientist, and he enters just on cue as the crew, Shinohara, and sorry, what is the name of
Noazumi? Azuma Shinohara, and who is Kanuka Clancy? Kanuka Clancy are all out for lunch, and also what's playing on the television? Pop star playing the theme song to this anime. They are getting their money's worth out of this theme song.
I love that because this was the episode. Maybe it's also because I'm editing the podcast itself, and that is I'm hearing the song a lot more that way. But yeah. I really like this theme song, so I was very
it's a good
about
theme
that.
Song.
It's a good song. It's really catchy.
Harada shows up and orders fried Vienna sausages and rice, which I think maybe I'm a little hungry. Made me go, I need that right now. I want that.
I'm gonna just order that like exact order from wherever.
You
I
gotta
go
be
next.
Able to get that in LA. I feel like.
Yeah.
I bet.
I don't know. Well, I was curious, is this before we start getting like a little bit of the internal debate? Because there's a press thing about newspapers and it's like monster discovered, unknown creature in Tokyo Bay and this stuff.
Yes.
And then we also get Clancy being like, it's a whale. Like, no way it's a monster.
Mm-hmm.
Which is interesting. And then I think somebody else, Shige, he's doing this like extra work to get the dry ice because he thinks it's an evolved creature from the Cretaceous period or something. So there's a lot of theories flying around at this point.
Yes. Then we see newspaper clippings. We have Clancy sort of playing the Mulder of the episode. Or Scully? Who's the one who's not crazy? Scully. Yeah, my bad.
Scully. Scully is the not the, I guess it's a cynic. There's the cynic, and Mulder is the one who believes.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
So Clancy is being our Scully. Now, this is maybe the funniest, like, outright gag we've had so far in the show, but we are in the lab with Harada as we have a scene in the lab with him where he starts explaining what he thinks is going on here. And there's footage of him looking through a dual-eyed microscope, and he has his eye patch on, and he's squinting and he's trying to see, and then he flips up the eye patch and reveals that he has two good eyes. So he's a freak. This character is a fucking freak.
He's just so stupid. Why are you doing this? It's just like, it's aura farming, proto-aura farming with his fake eye patch.
Go ahead.
Doesn't he just walk into the restaurant? Like, I'm trying to remember how he gets them to be like, you gotta listen to me. I know what's going on.
I think he looks at him. Yeah.
Yeah.
They kind of glaze over it because, Shinohara is talking about this whole case, like sort of building up. It's like, oh, we've got these weird theories and these monsters. The only thing that's missing is a mad scientist. And then that's when he walks through the door.
Right.
And they kind of glaze over how they end up going back to his mad scientist lab. But Clancy,
there's jars of different like aquatic creatures. There's some big computer screens and science stuff. But mostly this is like a scene of like, it's not like a, I guess it's kind of a montage because he's like reviewing what he's been doing for the last decade or so.
Yeah.
Yes. He's a guy who believes that And I don't actually know whether or not this scientific theory is real, because I've heard it before. But he's a guy who very strongly believes in a Cambrian explosion of different forms of life caused by, bacteria from outer space landing on Earth. And in order to prove his theory, he essentially goes insane and starts rapidly evolving life in his lab to sort of speed run evolution.
Yeah. I do like how we get to this point where at first they bring up panspermia. I think that's the thing that's a bit more theoretical. The Cambrian explosion,
That's an actual theory, but it also reminded me of an episode of the first season of Pokemon where I think it's like the Clefairy episode where they're just like, yeah, we theorize that Pokemon came from the moon and they crashed. They crashed here on Earth. I'm like, oh, wow, there are crackpots everywhere.
The thing that's interesting is when he brings up, he's like, do you know about the panspermia theory? And then
of course,
Clancy,
doctor.
Yeah, and then Clancy, who's just like shoulders crossed in the corner looking at a big tank of something, and she just like explains it to a T.
Perfect.
She just knows shit. She's just hyper intelligent, which is I kind of do like the characterization of here, both being a cynic or a skeptical, but she also knows every scientific theory. And we're not done like showing how her character could be wildly different all within the same episode. But there's this other thing here where he specifically found a meteorite with alien cells in it. And so his whole like evolution experiments are from one of these like panspermia cellular life that in his theory caused the Cambrian explosion. Like that is a thing we know happened. There was a bloom of life in that era of ancient Earth, but he's saying this is why it happened. And so the evolutionary like experiment he's doing is kind of like a rerun of Earth's evolutionary life. Like he's like evolving kind of the same stages of life, which is not how this would work. This is very weird, but it's funny. It's a good montage.
And now at this point in the episode, in our first viewing of it, how convinced are each of us that the end of the episode is just going to be that it is a Pat Labor swimming around underwater doing stuff, and this guy is completely out of his off his rocker, and nothing he's talking about actually had any effect on the plot?
I thought it was going to be a Pat Labor. I thought it was going to be bring back my ghost from Big O, and it's just like
I thought we're looking at a Scooby Doo.
We're looking at this is a Scooby Doo. This is a Scooby Doo.
I thought Clancy was right. I thought it was going to be a whale. I thought we were like, that was building her character that like, you got to listen to her. She knows what she's talking about kind of thing.
And then
how did the whale get the car off of the pier, Clayton?
It, you know, it goes like flops on top and just kind of drags it under its chin.
I don't understand how that works, but like, sure. Okay. But it's like, also like, it sort of like connects to like the previous episode where you have like, what is it? Beach House, whatever, they were talking about how the reason why they were protesting against the Babylon Project because of how it would affect the sea life in Tokyo Bay and all the other stuff. I'm like, okay, all this stuff is sort of connecting in a weird way. And like,
that was also kind of what I was thinking.
Yeah.
Why I was banking on that theory. But
right.
So
we didn't see this coming.
Hirata ends his rant about forced evolution by saying, and whoopsie, yes, the life form that I created, I did release it back into the water because I got scared of it.
It started evolving and now it's probably like a lizard creature that could lay eggs. Like he's telling them, like, that's now the problem, is if we don't stop it soon, it could lay eggs and propagate all over the world.
It's like,
also another cool shot in this where it's like his face, half of it, the side with the eye patch, is in like shadow, and the other half is behind like a red bubbling beaker. So you're getting like the two-face motif kind of thing. That's really cool. But and it's heightening how, like, I think at that point he's describing how he like stopped eating, stopped contacting other human beings.
Stopped trying to get married, and just like, man, this guy really put everything on hold to just hyper fixate on this whole project that he then got too scared of and then just dumped in the ocean. That the whole revelation about that also reminded me of Bong Joon-ho's The Host. It did remind me of that. Just dumping in the water. I'm like, there's no problem with that. I'm just like, I don't think you should do that.
I was going to say, like, men will hyper evolve a reptilian creature instead of going to therapy.
But yeah, they will.
So at this point, the unit, the second division, is more or less kind of on board with the idea that they might be dealing with some sort of undersea creature, mm-hmm. and they set up an operation to catch it and neutralize it.
Specifically, I mean, Clancy is on board. She is now 100% like, I want you to get the riot gun armed and loaded. I want you to destroy this thing into a million pieces. Only thing is Oda, you do not fire without my command. And Oda's like, yes, sir.
Yep.
Yeah. She says the line, since we know it's not a whale, there's no need to hold back.
Yes.
Okay, yeah. Clancy. Okay.
I'll say at that point, I did not think it was a whale anymore.
Here goes the American. I was like, okay, Clancy.
They get a military parade, essentially, out of the hangar and down the highway on their way to go destroy this whale. And this is the most jingoistic, like, comically so portion of the show that you've ever seen.
Yeah.
As they leave their base and all of their engineers are cheering them, they're going down the road, all of the civilians are cheering them. And then there is, again, the Pat Labor punchline where you get the aerial view of their trucks heading down the sideway and you see the absolutely massive traffic jam they have caused.
Yep.
So good.
We have to keep noting that because I think it's going to be every episode there's car traffic.
No. They're heading down an open freeway. And you see them moving down it in this wide shot. You see the freeway heading the opposite way and the underpass going under it completely fucking backed up.
If you learn nothing else from Pat Labor, just know that driving in Tokyo during rush hour fucking sucks.
Don't do it.
And in this case, it's because of these guys.
Yeah. Also, there's always parades for the giant robots.
Yeah.
And then so immediately after this parade, it switches into hurry up and wait mode. They get to the water. The creature is moving towards them and then boom, stops moving. And we shift gears from we're about to have a fight to, oh God, it's Pat Labor. So we're going to wait around again.
Nighttime duty. They're just on the edge of the bay. They got the lights shining, but they're all just kind of standing there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I also like this little line where they note that one of the Pat Labors has the riot gun and they're like, Clancy, we never said you use the riot gun. And she just says, it's okay.
This is tonally off things in this episode that I think is absolutely intentional. Like even like Shinohara's character in this episode, he's being way more of a protagonist than he usually is, mm-hmm. and like sort of talking in like this enthusiastic sort of noble way that he just doesn't.
He's doing also this little like narration thing where he's like talking to the viewer as though this had already happened, and he's kind of recalling what he felt and what they felt like while it happened. So it's like not exactly a narration, but it's interesting. They definitely haven't done something like that either.
Then we have a bit of a gag where we see multiple solutions proposed to the situation to move the situation along, and they're all shot down for logistical reasons. Again, classic funny Pat Labor stuff.
Very explicit reference here too, is each one gets a title card with like the next plan they're proposing with the mm-hmm. Godzilla roar behind it, like just straight up.
And what ends up moving the situation along is that Shige shows up with his homemade oxygen destroyer, and the chief wrestles with him about it, saying you can't throw that in the water. It's what the hell's that going to do? It's not going to work.
I knew you were up to something, so I've been following you the whole time.
Coincidentally, their scuffle, it falls into the water, goes into the hole that the monster has been hiding in, and monster emerges. Go ahead.
I think before we reveal this, I think it's funny that, so they go through the plans. Well, electric shock to draw it out. That could kill the fish. Nope.
Yes.
Sound waves. That can sometimes cause aquatic creatures to lay more eggs. Nope. And then... the tearful persuasion plan, which
how could I forget?
Let's have the dad of the monster, the dude who created it, go out there and try to reason with it. And this is such an interesting thing, which I know is totally riffing on this common kind of idea that happens in these Godzilla movies, which is, you know, what if somebody can communicate with the monster? Maybe not, maybe not Godzilla, but Mothra or something. Like this happens in these kind of movies. And he has this really hilarious like reaction to it, which is like, it's a good idea, but it's possible that by seeing the person who created him and created him and punished him in this malformed body will be so outraged seeing me again that he could just go on a violent rampage in the city. But also, I'm totally down to do it. Just to reiterate, it could go really, really wrong.
I'm just letting you know.
I am down to do it.
Yeah.
It's so funny. Yeah. He's, what if it harbors misgivings about its own existence?
Yes.
Such a funny theoretical leap to make about the fish guy that you made.
They're thinking of it as like a reptilian monster. Obviously, all the Godzilla stuff is pushing us to think that way. And this is the plan they're like about to execute before the pratfall and the dropping the oxygen destroyer.
So the creature emerges after it gets bonked on the head by the oxygen destroyer, and it is in fact a big guy. And at this point, I was like,
not just any big guy.
Yeah.
Not just any big guy.
He looks a little familiar.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's an actual kaiju, though. This thing, this scaly, you know, 40 foot tall beast comes up out of the water, and it's there leering, looking over them.
If I had to describe it, it would be a scaly, fanged Bigfoot.
Yes.
Like it's a primate-ish, but almost in the way that people draw Bigfoot, it feels like. But then he's got scales, like aquatic, and it's cool design, but it just kind of rises out of the water and stands there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he's got a bear face, right? Like not like an animal, but like a bear human face sort of emerging from these scales and hair and all this stuff.
And human side of that face looks suspiciously like Hiromi Yamazaki, the big burly like support guy for
the gentle giant sort of himbo dude in the crew
for SV2 who makes his own lunch, and he's just supportive and nice, and he just stares into its face, and they just stare at each other, and they have like this mutual sort of like understanding that passes between.
They have a moment,
like a real moment. I'm like, what?
It's really funny, yeah, because when Yamazaki recognizes the face of this thing, he doesn't, like, he fully sprints over to it and
down the
stops
dock,
right in front of it, down the dock, and just, sets up right in front of it, and they just, like, share this gaze. And I remember the narrator says, a little time passed, and then a lot. Which is really funny.
It's beautiful.
As they just have this, like, sort of neutral-faced stare down, and then the monster turns around and walks away, walks out to the ocean. And narrator points out, this is a dramatic and all too unsatisfying end to the story. Never had a chance to give him a name. It was almost like a dream.
Oh my God. Such Mamoru Oshii bullshit. Always ending it. Oh my God. They literally said this like when I was reading the book about headgear forming, that like one of the guys, I think it was the character designer or the mecha designer, which is like, I don't want it to all just end up being a dream at the end, because they're making fun of like Yurusei Yatsura 2. I'm just like, he can't help himself. You got to give him just one.
I like almost how they end in a way where it's like, don't ever ask us about this. This is not. This is done. He's gone.
Yeah.
Don't think about it.
Everyone's got their Godzilla episode. This is the one that we just don't talk about. It's just like, yeah.
I don't know. If it comes back, that's interesting. But like, I thought, especially by the time it gets to Pat Labor 2, the movie, that this is a very like grounded and serious political thriller kind of series.
It becomes also way more grounded as it goes on.
But there is a kaiju ape monster out there. You know, just don't think about it.
Yeah, just don't think about it. Yeah,
like, we're cool now, though. They had a heart to heart.
I've got it. Kind of reminds me of a not nearly as good cartoon, but the Clone Wars series has this, like, I can't remember, it's like a two-parter where they unearth a kaiju. They call it the Zillow Beast, and they bring it to Coruscant, and it ravages like a part of Coruscant and almost kills the Emperor. I guess at that point he's the Chancellor.
The Senate, Chancellor Palpatine.
Chancellor,
why didn't they reference that in Andor?
And that's what's funny is that they like never referenced again. There was literally like 100 9/11s on Coruscant caused by a giant monster. Never talking about it again.
We're never talking about that again.
It's the opposite of never forget. It's let's forget right now.
I need you to dissociate from this right the fuck now.
We haven't brought up labor yet, and that's because we needed to get to the point that the large monster was actually revealed. Because here's Pat's train of labor thought.
Yes.
I started thinking about the guys inside the big kaiju suits and what life is like for them. And so I started trying to do some partially unsuccessful research on, are those guys unionized?
That's a good question.
The like, guys inside about, the Godzilla suits?
Yeah, Subaria Productions or whatever, the people who founded like Godzilla, who were the special effects designers. Yeah.
Yeah. And so what I found was not necessarily about unionization, but was about the working conditions of being inside those suits. We all may know Haruo Nakajima, the original Godzilla actor from 1954 till 1972, donned the Godzilla kaiju suit for the first bunch of films and did it dutifully in a way that, like, I would compare to, like, I mean, the closest comparison I have is, like, pro wrestlers or stuntmen, right? Where, like, part of the ethos of this, the mythos of this character is you take the bumps and you get back up. And part of admiring them is, like, gee, he got the shit kicked out of him doing this, but he kept doing it.
Godzilla never breaks kayfabe, ever.
Never. And actually, notably, Nakajima got more into actually choreographing these films, he did base a lot of the stuff on pro wrestling.
Hell yeah.
But he had a couple of scary labor events in his life. One in which he was burned by pyrotechnics. But it's noted whenever he has these things that he, quote unquote, didn't complain, right? And he kept going. And he's quoted in saying, "I want the director to think I'm immortal."
I think it's important
the most boss-ass shit I've ever heard. Yeah, but also, you need to campaign for better protections and insurance.
Don't ever tell your boss that. Don't ever say that to your boss.
Don't ever say that to your boss, because they'll be like, okay.
I mean, it is indicative of a very different film studio structure than the one we have had for about 100 years. Because it was very, very common in Japan. The way you worked under a film studio was more or less you were an employee of a film studio, right? Actors and performers were much less free agents than they are over here. And a lot of times, if you were a director, you'd made movies for one studio. If you're an actor, you made movies for one studio. So his mindset going into these films was that he really did want to ingratiate himself to the bosses. He wanted to make himself, you know, essentially he was willing to suffer as much as he needed to keep this job and keep doing it, which is sort of the opposite, not necessarily opposite, but it's a system that you try to work against in labor organizing because you don't want to have a bunch of people who are willing to kill themselves for somebody else to make money.
It's not going to make a better movie, and it's not going to make a better Godzilla. It's like, but you appreciate the dedication, but at the same time, there's a better way.
I feel like you hear this in echoes of, like, I'm thinking of it because I touched it, the media industry, especially a couple decades ago, especially of the, like, the low paying job at the cool place, or the, like, the internships that barely pay anything or nothing, which is either means you already have wealth or you do have to essentially, like, sacrifice your body to do the job because it's, like, desirable.
He also had scuba training, which he credits with helping him get through the scenes where Godzilla would have to either be underwater or emerging from water, at which point the suit would completely flood, and the material of the suit would just become saturated with water and would gain like 100 pounds. So, like, if he's doing a scene where he's coming out of the water, like, that suit weighs like 200 pounds.
That's a pretty typical scene in Godzilla movies.
Yeah, he spends a lot of time in water. But yeah, he kept that up through the 1970s. But thinking about the kaiju in this episode made me think about Godzilla. Then that made me think about, are there unique protections for costumed performers in the Screen Actors Guild? I couldn't find anything. So what I think is, I believe most of the sort of concerns that you would have doing costumed work are covered by the general contract that you are covered by when you are in the Screen Actors Guild, right? Mm-hmm. So anything involving like the amount of weight you're carrying, the danger that you're going in, the amount of time you're allowed to be in certain situations, they don't necessarily make distinctions for whether or not you're in a Godzilla costume.
Or a C-3PO costume.
Or a C-3PO costume.
Or Big Bird. Do you know how the Big Bird puppeteer did it?
No.
Hand over his head, moving the beak the whole time. Like, my arm would go to sleep in like 5 minutes. Like,
but what happens with Big Bird's right arm then? Is it just vestigial?
So I think you'll notice this.
Yes.
He only really uses one arm, or he does like the both move at the same time kind of thing.
Both move at the same time, or the other one is sort of like gingerly like resting at his waist on his belly. You got to look closer at Big Bird.
I'm sure there's other complicated costumes that have these other things you don't even think about, like how hard it is to like hold in a certain position or how incredibly heavy. I heard that like that old sitcom with the dinosaurs in that era was when they were like getting so good that they're like, well, we'll put TV like little monitors inside so they can see. Yep. So those things weighed even more.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Big Bird had a TV around their neck.
God.
Inside that costume. I think even from like the 70s and early 80s on, it was like one of those TVs where it's like a monitor that goes like, that's like the size of like a sideways VCR and then has like a screen, a postage stamp size screen on it. And it was around their neck on a harness. And so the puppeteer had arm up looking down at this tiny screen so that they could see what Big Bird looked like from the outside when they were being Big Bird.
That's wild.
So costumed labor is extremely difficult and hard. There are provisions within the SAG contract that for things like putting makeup and costumes on and off to make sure that people are fairly compensated for any extra work that adds to their day. So there's this concept referred to as the 15-minute rule within SAG-AFTRA, where it says the 15-minute makeup, hairdress, and wardrobe removal rule in the television, high-budget SVOD, and theatrical contracts provides that a performer will be compensated for up to 15 minutes for time spent removing ordinary makeup, hairdressers, yada, yada. So even if it's just standard makeup that they have to put on for the show, that's time that you get paid for. And that is a thing that rocks about unions is like, this is the kind of thing that seems like a huge pain point, right? Like when you realize like, oh Jesus, like I'm spending all this time removing the makeup that they had to put on me for the shoot and I'm not getting paid for that time. Now you are.
Yeah.
It's pretty
at least
cool.
Up to 50 minutes.
Yeah. I was going to say, I feel like, what was it? Mystique from those X-Men movies was like 8 or 12 hours or something.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking of Stellan Skarsgård from the Pirates of the Caribbean movies, where he was the only guy on the Davy Jones's like ship who actually had like the actual barnacles on his face. Everybody else was just like very impressive CGI. Yeah.
And so this took me to one last place because I was like, okay, that's like that's about hair and makeup and stuff. That's not about kaiju. That's not about monsters. Can I find something specific about the labor of being a guy in a costume? And the best I could get, and it is good, is that in 2024, the Disneyland costumed character employees did vote to unionize.
Hell yeah.
Solidarity forever.
Yes. Yeah.
So Goofy is now a union man.
He's a union man.
And this is from a NPR story, Magic United, Disneyland characters vote to unionize. Turns out Disneyland is not the happiest place on earth. At least it's not for some of the workers who walk around the park as Mickey Mouse and Elsa and Chewbacca.
Yes!
In a union election that ended Saturday, the Anaheim, California-based performers voted overwhelmingly to unionize by a vote of 953 to 258. The employees will be represented by Actors Equity Association, a union known for representing actors and stage managers in Broadway. According to the article, the union campaign grew out of the pandemic when performers started to have health and safety concerns around sharing costumes and having physical contact with visitors, including hugs from children. And they mentioned other like potential risks you know, dangers and hangups of doing this, which is like getting hurt by kids who are too excited, right? Like mm-hmm. kid runs up, like whacks you in the nuts or whatever when you're in your Mickey Mouse costume. That doesn't feel good. So you need protections and benefits to help deal with that. So they have successfully voted, and I haven't found updates on how that unionization process is going. But since they've been voted and it was supervised by the National Labor Relations Board, it's happening. And that means bargaining has to happen.
That's awesome.
The first time I remember this specifically was the medieval times. Is that what it's called?
Yes, medieval times. Yes. Yeah.
Medieval times had a union, and they had a really sick logo. So I always like, oh, man, whenever some group like gets to unionize, they get to make their union logo. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what's Magic United? And, of course, they use the, like, Mickey Mouse glove, but, like, in the fist. Like, very good.
That's amazing. Oh, my God.
One fun fact is that the other workers at Disneyland and Disney World, I believe, definitely Disneyland, like the people who operate the rides, I think people who work in shops and other capacities around the park are unionized currently under the Teamsters. And I was thinking how funny it would be if the costumed actors got in there with the Teamsters. I don't think it would be a perfect fit for the union, but like knowing that the guy dressed up as Pluto is a Teamster would rock.
That's amazing. Oh my God.
So that's the closest I could get to the labor politics of costumed kaiju acting. So I guess that fits if you consider like Goofy to be a kaiju technically.
I love this. I did not see this coming, and I've learned something that I had no idea. I had no idea even existed before. So thank you so much, Pat.
Yeah, thank you for that.
This has been wonderful. Great episode, great labor lesson. Like hell yeah!
I was just still excited to watch more Pat labor, and I have no idea what's going to come next.
This episode sort of was a can opener for me in terms of like I thought I had an idea of what the show was and where it was going, and now I am much less sure about what is going to happen in the next episode. Mm-hmm. The episodes, you know, so far the series doesn't have a continuity, right? Like it doesn't have an overarching narrative other than the world that it exists in. It's not like this is a monster of the week distracting from a plot line that has been seeded that they're following.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But now I'm like, okay, is this a one-off or are we going to have more stuff that's this weird and out there?
They are sort of passively mentioning the passage of time, especially when it comes to the necessary time and components it took to create the riot gun. I think, like Shige said, it was like four months and 16 days, which is very, very specific. And I get that's part of like the actual gag, but it's also like the fact that we knew, at least in the first episode, I think that it took place in January of that year, and now it's sort of like incrementally progressing. Time is actually passing in this universe. Yes.
And we do have, you know, continued references to the Babylon Project. So if I had to guess what is going to be the overall theme and plot of the season of the show, it's going to be something involving the Babylon Project.
But that's about it. That's the only thing I'm banking on is we'll probably have more discussions of that. But will we have more giant robot satire or police procedurals or another giant robot? You'll just have to see on the next episode of
you'll have to tune in next week, or just queue up your DVD player or watch the next episode.
This has been great. Good app.
Good app.
See you all in a couple weeks.
Yeah,
see you absolutely. Then. And thank you. I should always say this. Thank you so much for subscribing to Rogue. Especially if you're doing it at one of the paid tiers, we really appreciate it. If you stay tuned on the video podcast or check us out there, we're going to have a little more stuff to talk about after this. So stay tuned. But otherwise, we enjoy everyone listening to Pat's labor, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.